You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm very pleased to be bringing you the first part of James Acaster's third appearance on the show, a historic third appearance as James Acaster returns again, part one. Now, the whole of this 2-hour conversation, this is going to be the first hour, and next week I'll release the second hour in part two. The whole of it is available to everybody, but members of the Insiders Club were also treated to a special Q&A over Zoom, asking James their questions in person. Tons of invites went out, 70 people were in the room, and we all had a whale of a time. That audio is now available on the Insiders Club private podcast, and it was so much fun, we're going to do more of them with other comics. So for your future invitations to those, as well as all the extra content from every episode that has it, join now at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Most of this conversation is going to be about James's new show, his self-release special, Cold Lasagna, Hate Myself 1999, which I'm lucky to have seen both live and in its release format, in its pre-release format. It comes out on the 17th of December at 8 o'clock. Get this, 8 o'clock wherever you are in the world. So you can go to dice.fm/artist/James-Acaster-BBX60. I mean, you're not going to do that, are you? You're going to Google Dice James Acaster. But that will enable you to buy a ticket for the streamed version. It's not like Netflix where it goes live and it stays there for ages. It's on at 8 o'clock, and that's when it's on. So don't miss out. 8 p.m. on the 17th of December. Go to dice.fm or Google some combination of dice.fm and James Acaster. But don't follow James on social media, because that's not a thing anymore. As we will discuss in this episode, we're going to talk about the new show. We're going to talk about how raw it is. We're going to talk about the contrasts between this show and his previous work. We'll discuss his new cool guy look. And we'll discuss the pros and cons of having a right old go at the audience. We will talk about James's rejection of social media, the distance between his persona and his real self, and how he has in the past forfeited his sanity so as not to rock the boat. All of that and more. This is part one. Here's James Acaster. Let's start by talking about that, because there's loads to talk about the content of the show, and you know, I'll be led by you as to which stuff you still consider a spoiler, given tens of thousands of people. But let's just talk about how it's framed and the jacket and the glasses. Talk to me about that. Who is the track that's playing over the beginning?
So the track at the beginning is your friend of mine, Paul Williams. Paul Williams is a New Zealand musician, but also a comedian, who's a friend of comedians, and lived with us in Edinburgh for a couple of years as well. He's just someone that I've got to know over the years, and he did this amazing album called Surf Music in 2018 that I couldn't stop listening to. And 2018 was when I was, like, started writing this show.
Yeah.
And I was doing, like, work in progresses everywhere, because I had the Netflix specials come out in 2018. So every time I'd had a gig, I just wouldn't do old stuff, because I was thinking, well, they've seen it and I'm sick of it. I don't want to do any of that stuff. And I had a gig in, like, had some solo gigs in LA. And I should have just done all the stuff that I know works. But instead I was like, no, I'm going to do all the new stuff. I'm just going to do that and try and figure out the show. And it was a small venue, I think it was 70 seats. And there was no real backstage, and I kind of would have to be in the room when they came in, and there was nowhere to hide. And so, and there was the iPod was next to the stage as well. And I kind of like John Kearns did and just was like, well, I'm going to be standing around as they come in and I'll be playing songs off my iPod. I didn't know what songs I was going to play. And I played that EuroLeague song, which is the start of the thing. And because I was just really loving that album at the time, I just turned it up higher than I'd played anything else. And it got a laugh. And also I was on stage with the jacket and the shades. And I kind of like turned it up and it got a laugh. And then I turned it back down for the rest of the playlist and then just thought, I want to play it again. And I just played it again and turned it up. And it became like quite a little fun thing to do. And for a while, that was what I did at every time I did that show, was like when they were coming in, I'd be on stage and I'd be iPodding it and turn that song, kept on playing that song. And every time I played that song, I'd walk to the front of the stage and stare the audience down. And then I'd go back to the iPod and turn it down again and carry on doing it. And then I'd do it in the interval as well. And it was like, as it became like a longer show. Eventually, I had to stop doing it because during the run of this show, the way my audiences behaves changed. And so, like, yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll come on to audience in a bit. But with this show is clearly, and it's like, what, 2 hours and 20 minutes long, plus an interval? Like, it's a big, big show. And I remember when you were making, I remember when the 4 Netflix specials were coming out, which is still unique, as far as I understand. I don't think anyone's done it before.
I think so.
When that happened, you did the opposite of resting on your laurels. Like, I remember you saying, I'm doing some new stuff here. I was like, what are you doing? What do you mean you're doing new stuff? So that kind of, the work that went into this show is simultaneously your most honest show. And it's, you're not being an undercover cop in this one. You're being you, and you're talking about things that you care about. And that's like your work up until this show has really been characterized by, I'm talking about one thing, but really I'm talking about something else. In this show, it's not to say there's no subtext or you play with that still, but you are saying this happened and this happened and this happened and these are all these things that meant to me. At the same time, you're wearing the jacket and the shades for a lot of the time, so you're kind of, it's almost, I mean, I know you kind of had in repertoire, you had the kind of the stylistic decisions, but this is like you're playing a version of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're playing more of a contrived or a kind of a flourished version of yourself. And being more honest at the same time.
Yeah.
Discuss.
Yeah. It was, again, it's like, I guess with every show, there's no plan going in when you're starting doing the work in progresses for me. And I'm just going with whatever is fun. So like with that track and going like, it's just funny, it just feels funny. And then I realised eventually that in the song he says about 2017, I was saying goodbye and all this stuff, and I was like, oh, that's like the theme of the show and this song's perfect, but oh, that, so maybe that's why I liked it. And with the jacket and the shades, it was just like, I bought that jacket for Taskmaster. I was doing like in the studio things in Taskmaster, you have to like wear a bunch of different outfits, and I thought, I'm just gonna buy a bunch of stuff that I'd never wear. And so on that series of Taskmaster, every time I'm in the studio, I'm wearing a really bright colorful shirt or something. I was deliberately trying to not dress the same because I was bored of wearing autumnal corduroy. So I was like, let's like do that. And I just loved that jacket. I remember being really excited about wearing it. I wore it for the final episode of Taskmaster. And I was like, well, if that's all I wear it for, that's a shame because I quite like it. And so I started wearing it to work in progress gigs just to make me feel like I was doing a show. So I got a costume and I didn't know what the show was at that point. And I quite enjoyed wearing the jacket. And I think I was just like, you know, let's commit to this look a bit more. Also, I'd been given for Taskmaster again these trainers for the studio that were Avengers themed vans, and which I loved and was obsessed with, and I was just wearing them anyway. And so they kind of went with the jacket, and I thought I'll put some shades on, and then I look like I'm trying to be cool. And that'll just amuse me for, you know, I think sometimes I'm on my way to a work in progress and I'm thinking, oh, I haven't really got anything that new. But I want to, you know, scramble it around somehow and make it feel different so I will find something new. Like when you're trying to figure out an anagram and you just shuffle the letters around again and maybe you'll see what the word is. And so like going, if I just wear this tonight and I'll do the same material, but I'll have a different kind of swagger to me. There'll be something different in there. like mentally, so maybe I'll find new stuff. And just kind of, I quickly found that going on stage with shades, I just felt more comfortable. I felt like it was a mask. I can't really, and I can talk about personal stuff a bit easier because they can't see me. I've got this on and I've got the jacket on and I can, and I was doing the bravado as well and kind of going on. One of the things that I'd had on the last tour and like for my whole kind of career was people saying to me, "We're so glad you don't swear." And it was annoying me. So I was like, I'm going to go on dressed like this and just start swearing tonight. And that's what I'll do tonight. And it will amuse me. And I'll just see what reaction it gets. And if everyone had hated it, I probably wouldn't have done it. But like you go, okay, well, that was fun. And like, so let's continue to do that. So there's no, by the end of it, I realised that, oh, this whole thing, this bravado that I go on with and the kind of caricature of an edgy comedian at the start allows me to then do the personal show and feel like I've got a little bit of space between me and the audience there. I've got a little bit of like, it's not, I'm not giving you 100% me. I'm not just being myself and talking to you openly. You're not my friends or my family. You're an audience that I'm doing a show for. Yeah. And so that puts that in place. And also, just the themes of kind of, I guess, if there is any subtext to the show, and it's not really so, but because I do mention it and talk about it a lot, but it's the themes of freedom of speech or what is and isn't offensive in comedy and stuff like that. It's a much more subtler theme that's not as loud as the rest of it. But that's going all the way through. And so kind of like presenting myself as one of those kind of comedians felt appropriate the more that I did it, that I was kind of like, and kind of illustrating that I can talk about stuff that maybe feels a little bit potentially upsetting or edgy or offensive or whatever. And actually, you can take those themes that you claim people are not letting you talk about as a comic, and then you can just talk about them from a completely different angle, and it's fine to talk about that theme. And it's not the theme, it's what you are saying about it. And kind of like presenting it like that. And that kind of, less to the audience, but more to me on stage, became a big part of what the show was.
And throughout this, and I guess this is true throughout the whole show and throughout your work, you're discovering stuff rather than planning stuff.
Yeah.
So that anagram idea I really love, of like, just, I've got a thing I want to say, which is whatever's on my mind, whatever's kind of hurt me today, or I feel rejected by today, or I've celebrated today. And I'm just going to go on and just try and do it in a different way such that I discover something, you know, connections appear.
Yeah. Yeah. And just like that fun. Because otherwise, if I try, like when I was an open spot, I tried so hard to be like, this is what this routine's going to be. And this is what, you know, the kind of comic I'm going to be tonight or whatever. And it just was so contrived. And like, you could tell it was a real effort. And actually, if you just discover organically, this is the best path for this bit. And sometimes you discover a path that, you know, you actually don't like, but the audience are laughing at it. You go, well, I'm going to go back to that crossroads and try and find a different way. Because, like, you know, you do discover rubbish stuff doing that method as well.
Yeah.
You know, you just discover...
It's very important to recognise when you've made poor connections.
Where you're kind of giving people a show that isn't as good as you could be doing. But, like, you know, I mean, this whole show was not... I wasn't like, right, I've done... The only thing that I kind of had in mind was I'm not going to do what I've just done again. So that was it. I was like, I don't want to do... And it's funny now talking about it like this, because like it's 2020 now. I filmed those Netflix shows in 2017. And it's funny to me now thinking that I filmed those shows and was like, right, you know, you've just done these... I was scared that was going to be all I was. No one else cared as much as I did about those shows. They was like, oh, there's some Netflix specials on and we'll watch them. Yeah, and people weren't walking around like, how's he going to follow that? They were just like, okay, I watched them and I liked them or I didn't like them. But in my head, I was like, because, you know, it was however many years of my life writing those shows, a year touring them, linking them together, and really thinking about how we filmed them, really thinking about how the set looked and the venue and all that stuff, and getting it how we wanted to get it, getting it on the platform that we wanted it to get it on, being allowed to release four all at once. And then in my head, I was just like, well, I don't know what I'll do now, because do I do five now? or do I do? Or what's right. What's the thing of going forwards? And like, yes. I don't want to not go forwards. I'll feel frustrated. I'll feel maybe even a bit embarrassed. And if I'm just staying in the same
place,
that's
one of the downsides of an incredible achievement like that. Is what do you follow it with?
Yeah, like
you continue stretching yourself. What do I do five now?
Well, that was the thing. You go, I mean, because the initial response is like people would say to me, like, you know, what are you gonna do? How many are you gonna do next? And you're like, oh no, that's not what I did. I wrote those over years, 6 years. And so what I wanted to do was actually the opposite, almost. So I'm saying like. So I was so stressed about moving forwards and progressing that I almost tried to do the opposite and write a really scrappy... So that's why I was doing stuff really quickly when you saw me.
Yeah,
and I was chatting to you and saying, I'm doing new stuff at this place. I was like, I'm going to do this. This is going to be shit. Like, almost like this is going to be... I'm going to do a show that's not as good and I'll release it and it'll be like... you know, there's some musicians that I really like who release an album... that is way more impactful than anything I've ever done. But like something like, you know, Neutral Milk Hotel. I love Neutral Milk Hotel. Or actually, no, a better example is Songs I Hire, Jason Molina. And they released Magnolia Electric Company, sorry. And they released that album. It was like their best album. And then the next album he released was just him and a guitar. And it was hardly any melody to speak of and quite droney and very difficult.
Yeah.
And didn't sound like he'd put the same amount of effort into it. And you're like, oh, okay, well, we're just not going to get that again. And he's kind of telling us, you know, that thing that you liked, well, you're not getting that again, so don't expect me to do that again. And I kind of felt like, I want to do that. I want to go, I'm not going to do that again, so don't expect it. And instead, I thought, I'll just go on and I'll just talk about however I'm feeling. And it just happened to be that I was in a bad place.
Yeah.
Mentally for 2 years when I was writing that show. And so any material that I tried that wasn't this stuff that's ended up in the specials didn't work. And I wanted it to work. I even tried to frame the same stories in a similar way as I'd framed the specials at one point. At one point, it was going to be that I was in prison.
Taking on more and more of the justice system.
Yeah.
Next time, I
got it in my head one day that, like, oh, well, you've done these four things that are set in the same universe. What a shame if you move out of this universe now. Like, no other comic's done a whole career that exists in one fake universe. So you've got to continue that. I was like, right, okay, so it's about being in prison. And I tried it at one thing, and you could just feel the audience who were, you know, they'd seen the other shows and stuff. You could feel them go, no, not anymore. Like, you could just feel it. That's like, this doesn't feel right. We can tell this is...
James Acaster Extended Cinematic Universe is maybe not the direction to take it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of bad choices and a lot of, like, stuff like that,
And I think when you... Because you had that kind of, like, I'm going to dash this show off, do you know what I mean? I'm just going to scribble it out. You ended up, obviously, doing a show that was kind of not... I don't want to say it was more honest. I don't want to imply the previous shows were less honest. But this is, you know, there is no kind of... It's not like a puzzle box where we have to work out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You've spent years building up this ability to finally tool something, to take... you know, whatever absurd thing and find not only a sort of whimsical comedy in it, but also a kind of a deeper meaning to everything. And it's like, well, you've got those skills now. It's like you've been a one-liner guy for ages and now you're talking about yourself, except it's spilling out of you in one-liners, to use a wrong analogy. But you know what I mean? It's like, you obviously, the finished show is really finely tooled, but the bedrock of it is just you often quite angrily saying a thing. I mean, the bits when you're insulting the audience and calling them dorks, and I mean, that's a nice little setup at the beginning. By the time that you are admonishing them in advance for the tweets they're going to try and send you after the show is just so lovely, and you're so angry and so honestly angry.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, like, we've had conversations, you know, we've had private conversations in which you've said some of those things, and I'm like, he's saying all this stuff. Yes, come on. So was it kind of liberating, and were there any drawbacks to that kind of emotional? I mean, I keep trying not to say taking a big emotional shit.
Both those things. It was liberating, and scary and like I would have work in progress shows that when I started to figure out what the show was, because I tried to make it, initially the show was going to be the best year of my life, because I was in a bad place mentally, I wasn't doing great, I knew I'd had a really bad year, and I thought instead of going out there and doing worst year of my life show, I'll focus on stage on the best year of my life. So initially it was like, let's do that. So like I got a load of material about 1999 being the best year of my life. But the more I did it, the drop, I never had material before have such a short shelf life of being like, it was exciting at first and then very quickly the audience not buying into it. And you could feel them looking at me going, what's going on here? You're like the guy who's going around telling everyone he's okay and he's not okay. And it kind of felt like that. And so I kind of was like, well, I has had some shows where I was like, I'll maybe just talk more about, like I'd start from about 99 and then I'd compare it to my life now. And I would start, I do a lot of it improvising in the work in progress show. So then I'd just start talking about something that had happened recently. And that would go better. And it would be something I hadn't experienced before on stage. I hadn't experienced like telling quite a raw personal story that was quite negative and even sad at points, and actually getting a good reaction from it and not getting the audience like, feel sorry for me or go, what the hell is he doing? We don't come and see him for this stuff. And those shows, those work in progress shows, started getting really exciting, and I was telling them, about personal breakups I'd had, professional difficulties, stuff like that, and it was actually going well, and I'd come away from those work in progress ones feeling like that was the most I've ever enjoyed comedy, and it's the most excited I've been on stage, it's the most connected I've felt to an audience, like I really felt they were there with me, and in a completely appropriate way that wasn't like crossing any boundaries, like I really felt good about those shows. And then I'd have work in progress shows that went badly and they didn't laugh at those stories. And I would come off really stressed, really anxious, really worried that what I was saying was going to get back to the people that I was talking about in the routines, that this is just a really bad idea and it's actually going to cause a lot of personal problems for me that isn't worth it, for the risk of just having a few laughs on stage and doing a show. I had shows where they didn't laugh throughout and then I'd say something that would, for want of a better word, trigger someone in the audience. And I've had people cry at the shows and not just cry quietly, but like speak out and say something to me and then get upset and cry. And then I had a work in progress where I was literally like just sat there talking to a guy while everyone was walking out because okay, I worded that routine bad or I set that routine up badly because before I could try and figure out a routine about apricots and I'm not going to upset anyone. And if the routine isn't funny, it's, that comedian wasn't very funny tonight. But with this, it was like, if I mess this up and I don't word it right, I could upset people. I could put the wrong message across. People could misinterpret things about my personal life or about my mental health or about their own mental health. And it became something that I was definitely so many times considered not doing the show, and so many times I've considered not even putting this special out on, and getting scared. And at least now with the special, I can watch it back and go, okay, no, that is what I want. It's fine. Yeah. But like before that, when I was just doing, I was scared, and also what that developed into is once the show had, I'd got it worded how I wanted, and I knew like this is how I want to present everything to everybody. I've got the show I want. But even then, when that was finished, I would, have tour shows or festival shows doing it that would go badly because that's what the job is. Some shows go badly. And again, before, if I was going on stage saying I was an undercover cop and the show went bad, they just went, that show was bad and that comedian didn't do a very good show tonight. With a show like this, where you're talking about a bad year in your life, you're talking about your mental health and stuff like that, if you are not getting laughs or if you mess the show up, if you try and go off on a tangent that doesn't work and stuff like that, you're saying about the bits where I'm berating the audience, sometimes the gig's going badly and you do those bits and it feels more like you're lashing out, or you try and improvise around that. Sometimes you try and go even further to let them know I'm definitely joking, and even that doesn't work. And that, and then they don't come away going that show was bad. They come away going, he's got mental health issues. Yeah. And, and they would say as much, you know, on social media and stuff like that. And that would make me think, oh, this was a bad idea, because like now they're not coming away going that comedian was shit. They're coming away going James Acaster is mentally ill, and we're now going to talk about that online. And I had a lot of stuff on that tour where audiences would assume stuff that wasn't happening and would enjoy online, you know, putting it about that he's not okay, he's not okay. And I was, you know, I had to cancel the gig at one point for a very good reason. That was not about me. It was about something someone else had done. And the rumours that got started about, you know, amongst, it might just be a small amount of people, but it's enough that you go, oh, that's concerning, that just through doing a show, just through talking about your mental health, which is meant to be a positive thing, you can then invite people to go, well, then he's nuts. Then there's something wrong with him. Then he's not coping and all this kind of stuff. And that would sometimes make me think, maybe I just should have said I was in prison. Yeah. You know, you're like...
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You've always felt to them, your fans, as a kind of champion. We've talked about this before, that you're kind of like a nerd who won. You're a, you know, you're a kind of, you know, you're a froob. Who's, do you know what I mean? You're kind of angular and unwieldy and have those gears performatively, and yet can slap down Jimmy Carr. Do you know what I mean? Like, or, you know, other high status comedian on panel show of your choice. So you like, they're deeply involved with you, and I suppose that, like, does it in, like, maybe the risk you run is you invite that involvement by bearing your innermost.
Yeah.
So it's almost like you get the benefits from it, but you've got to pay the price for it. Now, something you do in the show really well is navigate that and other very difficult issues. Mm-hmm. You know, like you dance very carefully around saying this is a difficult experience for me, but I'm fine now, but let's get into it. Or this relationship ended in a preposterous way that you won't even believe, but let's talk about it because it's true. And then the stuff with leaving your agent, mm-hmm. that kind of material. Part of me wondered, actually, when I saw it, because the show that's coming out on the something of December, 17th of December, is it's not being released then, is it? It's being streamed once.
Yeah.
Is that part of the decision to do with, like, that's behind that thinking, is like, you don't really want people to have it in their houses and rewatch it. You want to go, that was that, and now it's done.
Yeah, for now, it's an experiment at the minute. It's release this and see how I feel afterwards. You know, see how people behave, see if it's going to be fine. Yeah, I would like it to be something people can rewatch, but I don't want it to be something that becomes a thing for me to have to deal with. So, like, you know, so yeah, there's just like, you just kind of go, well, I'll release it once and we'll see how I feel.
And it also, because it isn't like, presumably one of the options was sell it to Netflix, right? Or someone along, I mean, don't want to make, you know, not ask you to burn relationships here, but you've got the world at your feet. I'm sure people will answer your calls from whatever distribution networks, but you've decided to self-release it, which I chuckled to myself in the kitchen a couple of days ago. I thought, oh, that's good. He's had his kits and eaten it too. You get to be this kind of like outsider self-releasing guy whilst also
that's, I mean, that's true of your career, isn't it? You're a kind of, not quite outsider, not quite artistic, but like you're your own guy, and you make your own decisions, and you also get, you know, your big TV guy and do all the panel shows. And I think I said to you before, you know, the clips of The Infinite Sofa that you were in have got 50 to 100 times as many views as anyone else. And that's, you know, other big name comics have been there as well. So like with the Netflix thing behind you, you like exist massively online in a way that I didn't really realise. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's like, and part of the kind of decision of like not being on social media and stuff was like, because of that, because I go, well, I won't exist, like literally online. Yeah. Like I'd take myself out of it because I'm not, and it wasn't like a, there was loads of different reasons for coming off of it. The main one just being something that everyone can relate to, which is that it's objectively bad for you.
Yeah,
so like, so it's not like, you know, and again, you kind of come off that stuff. And when you come off of social media, when you're on a tour talking about your mental health, people assume it's because you've had a breakdown.
Sure.
Whereas actually you've stopped doing a bad thing. you stopped doing something that's bad for you.
When you came off social media, like as in deactivated your account, would you still look at it? Or would you like cold turkey, don't pay any attention
to it? I didn't want to. Like, I just didn't want to. And like, I've kind of like peaked on it again since, but not for my own stuff. But like, so sometimes like if I've... like when we were releasing the Dice, when we were announcing Dice, I just wanted to make sure that it was announced properly. So like, yeah. I was looking on to be like, have they done that tweet? Is this out there? Do people know about it? Stuff like that. But I'm not on there going like who's saying this. And when I originally deactivated my account, I had no reason to go on there and had no desire to go on there. It was fine. But like, I kind of just feel like with that existence online, like that's for them, that's not for me. We've had conversations like that in the past about reviews and stuff, but you just go like, that's their thing, and that they're allowed to, like, you know, get into my comedy however they want. I hope they're getting into it in a healthy way that is that means that I personally as a human being don't mean too much to them, because I shouldn't do. It should be the show, and that should be it. The show, the podcast, the, you know, the book, whatever it is that they like, have the relationship with that, that's great. You don't have a relationship with me, and I hope you don't think that. Because like, you should just feel like, I like that stand-up routine, I like that show, but yeah, I can't do anything more than that for anybody. And
all you owe them is a show.
Yeah, you just owe them what you're putting out there, and that's the way I view the people that I'm a fan of. You know, I really love the fact that they've done all this these amazing albums or whatever it is. But, you know, I've interviewed them, and I always go into those interviews not expecting them to, you know, they're going to be my friend or they're going to be great. Like, they're allowed to be in a bad mood today. They're allowed to not want to talk to me, whatever it is. I mean, they've all been lovely. I've been very lucky with meeting my heroes. But, like, you know, but then it's not like they don't owe me anything more than the album that they've put out. And, I felt that if you're on all the social media stuff, you just see all the stuff that is, you know, not everyone's thinking about how they word stuff before they post it online, and they're not thinking about who they're tagging it and who they say it to. So, and it's not so much like, you know, some people think if you're a comic and you come off, it's because everyone's saying that you're shit or whatever. And it's more just feels inappropriate a lot of the time. You feel like you're around a lot of strangers who know you, and that feels a bit weird. And
yeah. You make that quite explicit in the show about how, like, it's almost that it's, well, I don't know if you say this specifically, but it's like it's not really their fault, because how on earth could they have the perspective that you've got? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, how on earth could they see it from your point of view when you're at the other end of all those connections? I've mentioned this loads on the podcast before, but there's a piece of writing Stephen Fry did years ago, and he said, everyone I meet has some connection to me. Everyone says, oh, you know, my cousin's hairdresser's friends, blah, blah, blah. To them, it only occurs to them that that connection exists.
Yeah.
But to him, everyone says that, because everyone he's ever met has gone, tell you who was in here the other week was Stephen Fry. Do you know what I mean? So they can't, it's like a Derren Brown thing. Like, they'll never see it from that perspective. Yeah. They'll never realise that. I mean, some of them will and be pricks about it and go, at James Acaster or, you know,
sure. Whatever.
So,
but it's just that, I think the thing I like to write in the show is that, like, yeah, writing is a job. Writing is a profession. People are professional writers and have to learn how to be good at it. And social media, people are not professional writers, and they don't choose the right words, and they don't word it very well, and they've got to do it in 148 characters or whatever. And they are not going to
accurately get across how they feel in an appropriate way, and some of it is going to feel creepy and full on, and they're going to say the wrong stuff. And if you're at the receiving end of all that, you go, oh, you know what, I don't really need this every day. Yeah. I don't need people, like, you know, saying stuff that sounds threatening or too intense and stuff like that at me, or just rude, you know. Yeah. And it's not their fault. Again, you know, before I did comedy, I probably would have you know, phrased things. I there's so many times I got in trouble with friends because I'd text them something. They're like, do you hate me? What is this? You know, so like, you know, you just, I remember Trevor Locke having, you know, I used to live with Trevor, and he had a go at me once for a text I'd sent that got misinterpreted. And he said, you're a comedian, you're a professional writer. Like, think about what words you're using. And I started doing that more in text messages and going, yeah, okay, how am I saying this? And,
oh, God, The occasional times I send a funny text, I send it far too fast because I'd send it in the moment and go, oh, this is the right thing to say in a group text message. Yeah. And then I'll just, I mean, it's like a, it's almost a trope of mine now. I'll say something and then I'll immediately text a little let down note joke, yeah, that says, I cannot stand by that comedy opinion. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I
can't, yeah, yeah.
Because for me, a big revelation I've had recently is about my fear of disappointing people.
Yeah.
And we have similar relationships to anxiety one way or another, and or have done. You talk in the show about your fear of rejection being like, yeah, a kind of almost like a foundational fear. And one of the things I've been confronting recently is how many of my life decisions I have made unwittingly in order to kind of swerve a situation in which I could disappoint someone.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, how many things did I not even realise that at the time I was making a sort of not implicit, like a, what's the word? I just didn't know that I was making a decision because it was easier to do that than risk disappointing someone.
Yeah.
Have you had that with the kind of rejection thing? Because there's obviously, we can look back at our lives and go, well, I realise now I'm this sort of person, mm-hmm, and that's why I did X, Y, Z. But I've kind of recently been sort of falling into a bit of a rabbit hole of going like, God, it's not even the X, Y, and the Z. It's not the stuff up there. It's the big decisions that, yeah, I made.
Yeah, well, definitely like a lot of my relationship, like, I guess, yeah, a big part of what the show is about is like so many relationships, professional and personal, where I didn't want to upset the other person or disappoint them, and so would kind of forfeit my own kind of sanity sometimes, or like how I was doing, in order to kind of like not rock the boat too much and go, okay, so I'm gonna have to put up with whatever it is, you know, a tougher time for a bit because I'm trying to weather this thing on my own, whereas I could just turn to the other person and go, what's going on, can we talk about this please, or something like that. And especially in, like, you know, I say in the show, you know, just for ages I just was never the one to end a relationship, and it's because, like, I would realize at the same time as whoever I was with at the time, I'd realize at the same time as them, this isn't working. And then I would just do nothing. I would just go, I would convince myself, oh, I'm maybe imagining this, and maybe it's fine. Whereas they were thinking, this really isn't working, and why is he...
Yeah, right.
But what's going on? No, expected me to do the breaking up, but like it meant that all the pressure was on them, and I wasn't even acknowledging it. And so, and definitely I've had relationships where, towards the end, I was just an absolute, like, just constant buzz of anxiety, but I didn't realise that because I never put that label on it. And that was, which is part of doing this show as well, which was kind of going, oh, I'm labelling things properly now. That's anxiety, that's stress. It's not, you know, it's not that I'm paranoid, or it's not that I'm in love. You, yeah, know, like, you're this person makes you sad and, yeah, stressed out and makes, yeah, your body want to run away, and that's not you being in love with them, that's your body being like, get out of here.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can happen, and I definitely didn't, I just didn't label any of those things. They were these like mysterious just little patches in my life that I could go, yeah, I wasn't quite okay for a bit there, but as if it was like a mystery. Mm. And not going, listen to your body. That was a big part. Listen to your body. What's it telling you? You're stressed out. You're anxious.
Yeah.
You're depressed. Whatever it is. And how much easier it would get then. It's not like it gets easy, as in like you can just breeze through it. But like realizing, oh, that's the situation. And so what's the opposite of anxiety? Yeah. Where am I trying to get to? How do I do that?
Yeah.
Rather than just going, I don't understand what's happening, and maybe I'm just crazy and stuff, because like that's crazy is the word that gets put in place of actual what's actually going on, and it stops you from ever understanding stuff. It's just thinking, well, I'm mad.
You say at the end of the show, I'm in a much better place now, in the best relationship of my life, you know, and it's one of the things with like having not seen each other, having not been in the same room since pre-pandemic. One of the things I noticed when you walked in, you seemed taller, which I think is because you're happier.
Yeah, probably.
How are you feeling like right now in life? Obviously, like, you know, we talk about the lockdown aspect of it and what changes that has made in a sec. But you seem kind of really together.
Yeah, thanks, man. I feel that way. I feel better for so many reasons. I mean, the relationship I'm in is amazing, and like is, you know. You have relationships that you end up in that, you know, you don't look back at past relationships and go think anything bad about those people. In fact, it does the opposite. It just makes you go, oh, they just weren't right for me and I wasn't right for them. And that was all it was. And we were two people who weren't right for each other, trying to make it work and finding that very frustrating. And now this is a completely different planet, and you kind of go, oh, this is... I just wish I'd met her when I was 13 or whatever. Like, what a life that would have been. So that's lovely. And also, like, you know, kind of talking about lockdown, like, I'd already planned to not do any gigs this year. That was the plan. I'd done a very, like, last year was the biggest tour I'd ever done. Hardly any time off. That was my own fault. But, like, it was very stressful and at times, you know, really got on top of me. And, just doing no gigs since December. So it's like nearly a year now doing no gigs, which is, since I started comedy, I've never done that. But like probably since even before that, when I was in bands and stuff, like it's just not being on stage. It just feels great and I don't miss it. And I'm not kind of going, oh, I really like to be in front of an audience and get that approval again and kind of go out and go, is this good? And they tell me it's good. And then I go home going, I'm good. Like, you know, it's like, I don't want that. I don't miss it. I don't, you know, and there's probably something about having filmed that last show and having that and being able to release it now. And it really feeling like, okay, that's, I don't know what I'm going to do in the future, but if someone said to me, you can't do stand-up ever again, that's not allowed, I wouldn't care. I wouldn't feel bad. I'd be like, oh, I did everything that I wanted to do and more. I didn't think I'd do any of that stuff. I didn't think I'd get to film shows. That was what got me into loving stand-up. The first stand-up I watched was filmed and just creating the show and filming it. Those two bookends, you know, writing it and filming it, I like my favourite parts. And to have been able to do that many of them, I just feel satisfied and don't feel like I need to go out and do something else. I'm really glad that this one is so different to the other four, because that means like I can feel like, I don't know, I think there's something in myself that is like, I don't think I worry about being a one-trick pony or anything like that, but you kind of go, oh, I did something outside of my comfort zone at the end of all that. You know, kind of like those Netflix shows were my kind of university kind of handing in your end of uni. I didn't go to uni, so I don't know what it's called, but when people hand in their thing
a dissertation,
yeah. That's what it felt like. And yeah. Then this felt like it's my job now, and this is what I now just instantly retire. but that might not happen either. Yeah, it might be that, you know, in a couple of years time I really want to do it again and I start doing it again and I find it's the most fun I've ever had. But definitely it's nice to be in a place where I'm not going, I felt it just after a while it gets unhealthy being in front of an audience again, that mislabeling of emotions. I lied for years to myself about being nervous, just said I wasn't nervous and it was fine, and I was really nervous. I was getting up in front of audiences, but I was telling myself I wasn't and that I was excited. When I was in college and we did a music course, one of the teachers told me and my friend Graham, he told us that excitement and nerves are the same emotion, it just depends if you're being negative or positive in your head, which is a lie.
I think I've perpetuated that lie to myself and to other people.
Yeah, but I then, so then me and Graham were like, okay, we're excited. So like that was like my motto for the rest of my, you know, life until like a couple of years ago. It was just like, I'm excited going on. Yeah, and that's why I feel this way. And then eventually I had to be like, oh, I'm nervous and I don't want to go out there. And I actually don't want to be in front of them. And I actually don't like the feeling of being in front of them most of the time. I feel too vulnerable. I feel too judged. And that's why I can throw gigs and I can throw it back in their faces. And it's not a riddle that I need to solve. I'm not enjoying myself, so I behave that way. And kind of going, so, like,
I'm really perversely pleased to hear you say that, because like, I, not that it's like any kind of pet theory or anything, but yeah. I do know when you said before, just a moment ago, that those are the bits you enjoy most, writing the show and handing in the DVD kind of thing, you know, those bits. Like, those almost are the smallest bits of it, because there's an incredible amount of being on stage in front of an incredible number of people. And I think, I don't mean this to be critical at all, but I think when I asked for questions from people, more so for you than I think most other comics, there's quite a lot of, when he did this show, he got really angry and he didn't seem to be having a good time. And there's a few of them. It's not like overwhelming. Yeah. But also, just having known you for a long time and talked to you about gigs, that comes up quite often that you've not tanked a gig deliberately, but I always felt like you lose your temper quite quickly with an audience if you don't get what you want. And I suppose that, I'm sure that has its roots in the difficulty of being on stage and the fact that you have been pretending to yourself that it isn't difficult. So that, I suppose, that advice, I still think it's sound advice that you can recognise. I think maybe the sensible advice is you can recognise that you are nervous and try to reframe it as excitement, as opposed to, if you're feeling nervous, you're a bad person if you consider it anything other than excitement. I feel like you've been carrying that around.
Yeah, yeah.
So that feels quite healthy to go, no, it's simply that I don't like that bit sometimes.
Yeah, but I'm scared of being nervous as well. Scared of being nervous, and then that meant that it might go badly. So telling myself I was excited so that I wouldn't be, you know, nervous and then it would go bad. But, like, I don't think I ever, like, really lost my... Like, I think losing my temper is a bit of a strong phrase, because I never lost my temper with them. It's that I would be feeling... Part of the theory, and the thing is that it would work... Like, throwing the gig and saying it was rubbish and stuff like that would work a certain percentage of the time.
Sure, yeah,
like
yeah,
a third of the time.
Work in the sense that it would turn it would lift the gig. Because it would lift
it
the
would
gig.
Be yeah, funnier yeah. and it would go well. And, yeah. And a third of the time isn't enough, but it would still be like, well, I know that can work. And a lot of the time it wasn't even when, if a gig was going awfully, I wouldn't mind as much as if it was just going okay. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, this is like, I was going to go, I'm a boring comedian. And I'd say, well, I'll just make this an event and see if we can get something. And sometimes it would, you know, it would become one of your favourite shows of the year by throwing it like that, and the audience would come away like, how much of that was real? How much of it was planned and all this? And it, you go, oh, what fun.
I'll never tell. Smoke bomb.
Yeah, yeah. But other times, you know, I understand why people would ask questions like that in your thing, because, like, you know, if I'm at a gig and I see someone throw it or something like that, I'm thinking, like, okay, what's going on there? Because my experience as an audience wasn't that. I thought it was fine. I thought it was going okay. A bit quiet in the room, but the show was what I wanted myself, and I wasn't laughing that much, but I liked the show. And why did that happen? And what, and that, and like, the answer to all of that is that it happens because, for the same reason that, you know, when you tell someone you're a comedian and everyone just says to you, how do you do that? How do you get up on stage? I would hate it. I'd be so nervous. You go, yeah, yeah, me too. And that's why it's happening. It's happening because I'm like you, and I'm doing what you would do if you were on stage, which is kind of like going, like, I can't. And but what I'm doing is I'm following, like you say about the believe in the anger on stage in the show, and going like, we can, you know, and it's scripted, obviously, that stuff about Twitter, but you have to believe the emotion for it to be funny. And a lot of the time, if I'm like, I know I'm not enjoying it, I'm frustrated, I'm stressed out on stage, they're not liking it, I don't really like the audience, and they're not laughing at me, the thing in my head of like, if I go in my genuine emotion now, I've got a better chance of making them laugh big and getting a big laugh than I have from any of this material I've got. And so it works sometimes. You lean into that. And sometimes, yeah, there are loads of parts in this show that came out of that and came out of, like, you know, all the Twitter stuff was me genuinely at one gig I think I'd come on after the interval and someone had tweeted something and I came on and was like, right, and then just did a whole rant about it and was like, oh, I could keep that actually.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I was always saying to myself, don't do that, don't ever do that stuff, then I wouldn't have found that bit. Also, though, you have to think of, like, okay, so here's the thing that's benefited me as a comedian and this show, but then there's another side to this, which is me as a person. And it's like that, again, that thing of like, don't be your own audience and get confused between the two. Like, you as a person is a different thing and you have to look after yourself. And if you are coming away from gigs going, I hated that, I hate myself, all that audience must think I'm a dickhead and must think I'm a petulant child and they won't understand why I was doing that stuff and I shouldn't have done it anyway. I've done it enough times that I know it was wrong and all that. And even, like, you know, I spoke to you about it on the podcast before and I've done it since. So it's not like a thing of, like, I'm ignoring it or I'm not aware of it. It's that in the moment, I feel like I can't help it. I feel like on stage when people aren't laughing very loud, it's not going that well, I feel like, you know, I'm staring down the barrel of an hour, sometimes 2 hours of this. And instead, I'll try and make something out of this or make, you know, like and with this show more than ever, that has sometimes made sense. And it's something, you know, a lot of it being about not being able to end relationships, codependent relationships that shouldn't be in that, and the kind of unspoken, well, not really unspoken, but the other relationship in that is my relationship with the audience. And when I was in Melbourne, that was a massive part of the show. It became a scripted thing. I had points all the way through the show where I'd have a go at the audience and say how much I hate Melbourne Comedy Festival. And they loved it. It went well there, and which was kind of bad for me in a way because it made me think, well, that's in forever. But then the next place you go is New Zealand, and they don't like that.
They don't like it
in New Zealand if you tell them New Zealand shit. And then they definitely don't like it when you then go around a tour of the UK and you try and do it, and then you go, oh, okay, that doesn't work, and now I've got to rethink this, and that audience think I've just gone out and been rude to them when really I was trying to do what was funny at other gigs.
The way in which you're talking about it now is so much more healthy. Do you know what I mean? Like, it sounds like you have really decoupled your work from your sense of self-worth in a way that is like, you know, hats off. You know, that Gary Goldman was on the podcast a couple of months ago, and he talked about the making an active decision not to let every performance be a referendum on his self-worth. You know what I mean? Beautifully put, you know.
Yeah.
I would imagine that what was at stake for you, given the anxiety you've talked about, your fear of rejection, like what's at stake for me when a gig is going badly is there's a sort of cockpit level of like, I'm looking at the instruments and I realise that this needs something else. And then underneath it, there's a kind of maelstrom level of like, I'm going to disappoint them. And that's like a physical sensation in my body. That's the kind of the deep stuff that it's like, oh, that's going to take years to unpick. Is what's at stake for you them rejecting you, a feeling that they'll reject you if they're not laughing? Is there that kind of visceral sort of connection to it?
Yeah, there's that. I guess a lot of comics have that thing of like a need for approval. Or I was watching the series of Taskmaster, and Marwan Rizwan said about, he said something at one point about, you know, I did a school play once and my parents didn't clap at the end and now this is my career. Something like that. And I was like, yeah, that's probably like stuff like that, like where you're chasing that approval for whatever reason. My parents are very supportive, but like, you know, from somewhere I've got this thing of like, I want that approval from people. And but I resent them for it as well. So it's not like a thing of going like, I want your approval, so now I'll do whatever you like. I'll do a little dance. I just want you to tell me I'm good. I go, I want this approval. I don't want to want it, and I don't want you to be there with the power to give it to me or not. And so I'd rather tell you to go fuck yourselves. And then in the moment I'm thinking like, because then you haven't got any power over me anymore, fuck you. But actually they still do have power. You still want them to like the show. You still want them to like you as a comic. And now you've gone, go fuck yourselves, and they've gone, oh, okay, this guy's a bit of a dickhead actually. And then even if they haven't thought that, in my head they're thinking that. In my head they're thinking, this guy's a dick. And now I'm like, now everyone thinks I'm a dick. And now I'm like, how do I do this? How do I turn this around? And then I come off stage and I'm really annoyed that I messed the show up. And you kind of go, this has to... Also, a big part of it, I'll say this as well, that is not my that's not my default setting, and that's who I am. I'm not going on stage wanting their approval, blah, blah, blah. I'm tired. Most of the time, I'm tired. I haven't had enough sleep. I'm doing a gig every single day for a year, and it's a two-hour show, and I'm talking about really personal stuff, and I'm travelling around, and I'm flying to other countries, and I'm exhausted. And then I go on exhausted and try and do this show, and they don't laugh. And then I feel I need their approval. I don't want their approval. Fuck them. They think I'm a dick? Oh, for fuck's sake. And then that's there because I'm tired. And when I'm not tired, when I'm rested and I'm fine and I go on and it's not going well, I just power through and do the gig. It's not like that's who I am as a person all the time. It's definitely not who I am off stage. But like on stage, if I'm exhausted and then, yeah, I'm just prone to the worst parts of myself because I'm just not on it. I'm not clear-headed, you know. If I've exercised in the day, didn't do a gig the night before, and I'm rested, go on, they can shout whatever they want at me. And I just get to the end of it, and I've ignored people, you know. I've ignored hecklers and just carried on and just not paid any attention to them at gigs before. And it's fine. So, like, a big part of it is just that.
Are you able to sort of actively put rest into your life? I mean, obviously now we're talking about a time when there aren't any live gigs, and who knows when you're setting foot on stage on tour again for a while.
Yeah.
But I fill every gap in my diary almost so that I can be stressed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I do wonder whether, like, I feel I've already in this conversation, I've sort of logged, oh, next time James starts talking about touring, I should text him every so often and go, remember to put gaps in.
Sure,
do you know what I mean? Like, what is it that makes you fill all the gaps? Is it just the demand and you don't like saying no?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it that there is something compulsive about filling all the time? Like, are you the architect of your own exhaustion?
Yeah, well, I think like loads of comics, you know, no one hands comedy to you. You have to get into the industry somehow through open mic circuit and doing gigs. And before that, I was in bands who, you know, trying to get into an even more impenetrable industry. And it was all just down to you making stuff happen for yourself. And so I was having to get gigs all the time. I didn't know how to do stand-up. Because I was new, so the only way to learn and get better was to do gigs. And so I had to try and get as many gigs as I could, especially because I was travelling from Kettering to London. Yeah. I had to justify that to myself. I didn't have a lot of money, and I was spending all of my weekly wage from this pub I worked at and the drum teaching I was doing. I spent all the money on travel and food going out to do open mic gigs. So I had to make it count. And had to do as much as possible and do as many gigs as I could in an evening. If I was in London for just two nights, if I could do more than one gig a night, then it was even more worth it. And also, it's like, well, I'm not going to get more gigs if I'm not getting better and doing well and people seeing me. And that is what happens when you're on the open mic circuit. If you're gigging all the time and you're getting better and other comics are seeing you, you get more gigs. Mm-hmm. So that work ethic really pays off, and all the comics that I know now who are professional comedians who started as an open micer with me, those were the comedians. No one who was doing that isn't a professional comedian now. Like, they're all working because we were just obsessed with, right, let's get as many gigs as we can and do this. And then there's not really a time for a while, I didn't feel there was, where I could just go, oh, I'm set now. This is my job forever. I'm all right. Like, you know, I was like, no, you know, now it's your debut Edinburgh. No one knows who you are. You've got to get that show together. And now you've got and like that went okay, but you're not on TV or anything, and you've got to try and get that now, or you've got to try and get on the radio. You want this thing. And you're constantly just trying to improve. And so that and that was the most fun bit as well for me, was trying to improve. So I enjoyed getting better. So getting all these gigs did make me feel, I look at my diary and it was full, and I knew that, well, that means I will get better, and hopefully, you know, this will become my job, or this will continue to be my job, or whatever it was. And you just do get to a point where you need someone to go, okay, you know what, you can relax a bit now. You don't need to keep on booking all these gigs in. It's okay. And like, yeah, you know, and luckily I have an agent now, who is just brilliant at that, and just kind of goes, James, you need to book yourself some time off. And, you know, last year I overruled them on a couple of those things and I paid the price. And they were, I'm sure they weren't happy about that, but yeah. I'm sure they were vague. A little bit of them were satisfied, going, well, maybe next time he'll listen to us on this. Because, you know, and, you know, before the pandemic and stuff like that, I had already said to them, no gigs this year. Don't let me do any gigs. I'm not doing anything. So I am able now to kind of like, you know, I feel, because of this show that's about to go out, I feel more like, not that I proved my point, but that, yeah, kind of proved my point, but to myself, not to other people, and not to kind of go into them like this, but like to myself going, okay, no, I'm a comic and that's fine. And that's, I've done my show and that's, you know, I feel like that's enough. Like I don't need to kind of like fill my diary. And I have had enough. I think last year was like the amount of times I did throw shows because of tiredness and stuff like that. I was like, okay, yeah, that's enough of this now. You've been throwing shows for too long, and you don't need to have this be a regular part of your life. You don't need to have this be a part of people's lives who've come to see you this evening. So let's just step back from this. You can just like ease off it and get a bit more perspective. So, but it took, you know, feeling secure in, myself in terms of like myself as a comic, not myself as a person, but just going like, okay, yeah, I would probably watch me now.
So that was James. I'm sorry to cut this off in the middle, but, you know, this was so fun. James was so giving of his time and so generous with his insight and his thought and his articulation of where he is and what he's doing, that I thought rather than chop half of this out and give it to the Insiders Club, I'd just give you both halves of it. So next week, James Acaster returns again, part two. And remember, if you are in the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders to join for a minimum £2 a month, but you can pay as much more than that as you want. Everyone gets the same benefits. You get all of the extra content from every episode that has it. And you also get the audio of a special one-on-one. It was one-on-one, 70-on-1. But I was able to sort of facilitate people asking James questions directly in a Zoom room full of insiders, very switched on comedy people with great questions to ask. James enjoyed it. We did too. The audio of that, I think it's just about an hour. That's now available on the Insiders Club feed. And if you are a member of the Insiders Club, you will also get invited to forthcoming ones of those. And honestly, it was so much fun. And crucially, if you know anything about me that you'll have heard from the postambles of this episode, it provoked in me no dread or anxiety whatsoever, because I just, like, I'd done my work by assembling a team of mega comedy fans who think deeply about comedy. And so I just had to sit there and casually run this conversation, and I just loved every minute of it. So we're going to do bundles more of them. So if you want to find out about them, comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Look forward to part two of this next week. And you can follow James. You can't follow. What am I saying? You can't follow James on social media, but you certainly can watch at 8 p.m. wherever you are in the world on the 17th of December. Cold Lasagna, Hate Myself, 1999. Dice.fm, or search some combination of Dice.fm and James Acaster, and you will find it, I'm sure. If you want to catch up with me, you can go to comedianscomedian.com. Send me your feedback, info@comedianscomedian.com. Follow me on social media, because I don't have enough of a following that they pester me. I'm so lucky. I reflected, not for the first time over this conversation, how lucky I am to have the sort of comparatively minuscule reach whereby for someone to have heard of me, you basically need to be cool. So if you would like to basically be cool, then you can follow me on social media @comcompod. And also, if you want to find out the other things I'm up to at the moment, go to comedyinsights.com to find out about my work talking to business about resilience. And indeed, you can go to virtualofficeparty.co.uk. If you are still at the 11th hour, struggling for something to do for your office Christmas party now that you're all working remotely, go to virtualofficeparty.co.uk and see what we have to offer. It's unique, it's brilliant, and we've got a load of them coming up in December, and I cannot wait. Speak to you next week with more James Acaster. Bye for now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.